The circumstances are unusual this year. Because of rain last Saturday and Sunday, five drivers still had a chance to win the pole position when this day began. Normally, that is decided on the first day of qualifying. Reporting with me today will be the world champion racing driver, Jackie Stewart. And here, you're looking over Jackie's shoulder as he drove through the streets of Monte Carlo last week. While he joins us live in Indianapolis today, you'll also see him and the rest of the drivers on the Grand Prix circuit as they competed last Sunday in the Grand Prix of Monaco. The fascinating run round the houses is the world's most colorful motor race in scenery and the intimate nature of the course. And then we'll have a look forward to ABC's upcoming coverage of the Summer Olympics in Munich, West Germany. You'll see the architectural marvel that will be the scene of the games. Indy, Monte Carlo, and Munich today on Wide World. And now we're at Indianapolis, live once again from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on a beautiful spring afternoon on race day minus seven. More than 100,000 people have gathered here to watch the cars go around one at a time as they attempt to qualify. The cars you saw on the racetrack right now are just practicing. No one is making an actual qualification attempt. As soon as they do that, we'll be going down to show it to you live. I'm Jim McKay, and this qualifying process is quite an interesting thing. We tried to explain it to you quite fully last Saturday afternoon, but again, briefly, qualifying at Indianapolis normally takes place over two weekends, 4 days, and your place in the starting field of 33 cars depends not only on your speed, but on the day on which you qualify. We'll be getting into that in much more detail as we go along. And remember, also this afternoon, we'll be seeing the Grand Prix of Monaco run last Sunday in Monte Carlo, and our preview look at the venues of the Summer Olympic Games in Munich, West Germany. Working with us in the pits will be Chris Economaki, as always, the editor of National Speed Sport News. And sitting with me, and we're very proud to have him with us again this year, as we did on race day last year, is the world champion race driver, Jackie Stewart of Scotland. Jackie, the speeds are incredible here this year. 17 miles an hour faster than the pole position of last year. It's an area nobody's really explored before. What's your reaction to it?
I think I've never been so surprised by speed, Jim. I think we always expect speed to increase every year. We expect lap records to be broken, but never by the margin that we're seeing this year at Indianapolis. The Bobby Unser effort is something unbelievable. I think technologically it's been a year of great advance. It's been a great year of tire development. It's been a great year of aerodynamics. It's been a great year of engine horsepower. And apart from anything else, it's been a great year for drivers, because some of the drivers really are excelling themselves.
Billy Vukovic in the field. Here were his words after.
Now, congratulations, Billy. That spin of last week on your mind as you qualified today?
Yeah, it was much more on my mind than I thought it would be. I was, you know, very careful. I didn't think it would bother me, but I've been practicing. I hadn't let it bother me, but when I got there to qualify, I was tiptoeing around pretty good, much more than I thought I would be.
Then came Jerry Grant, the man who came here just the day before yesterday, and yesterday took his first laps in the number 48 car, the Mystery Eagle, so-called, of Dan Gurney. This is a sister car to the car that qualified fastest, the one of Bobby Unser, and Jerry Grant really got it going.
I think this is a great credit to Jerry and the car, because this illustrates, with so very few laps completed, perhaps only 20 laps practice, to go out and do a time like he did to post the fastest time of the day is in fact an achievement, and a great, I think, achievement for Dan Gurney and the car builder, because the mechanics obviously have done a great job. Jerry's been around a long time. He's been racing at Indianapolis a long time, and perhaps this year he's got the best chance of success that he's ever had. I think his friendship with Gurney is doing him a great deal.
Okay, this was Jerry Grant, who turned in a time of 189.145, fastest qualifying time of this day. But remember, he was not eligible to compete for the first spots and for the pole position. He was a second-day qualifier, and therefore is somewhere back in the middle of the field, or will be on race day. Jerry Grant, into the field. There he is.
Jerry Grant, what are you doing here? Your name wasn't on the entry list, and we haven't seen you until yesterday.
Well, I went out of business as a car owner, and I decided that either I was going to drive a competitive car or go dig ditches. And I got together with Dan, and I got the greatest opportunity of my life, and we're going racing.
What appeared to be a hat on Jerry's head is actually the protective mask the drivers wear nowadays, and he just kind of rolled it up after he finished. We'll be back in a minute at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Tim McKay with Jackie Stewart, and remember that tomorrow afternoon on ABC's Championship Motor Racing Series, there also will be another live report on the final day of qualifying for this year's race. And a week from tonight, except in the Indianapolis area, we will be bringing you our coverage of the Indianapolis 500 itself, a two-hour telecast beginning at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. That's next Saturday, except in the Indianapolis area. It should be some race, and of course, Jackie Stewart will be with us then also. Let's take a look at the qualifiers for this race so far. In the first row, Bobby Unser with Peter Revson and Mark Donahue. Row two, Gary Bettenhausen, Mario Andretti, and Joe Leonard. Moving down to the third row, we have Sam Posey, Johnny Rutherford, and Swede Savage. In row four, Art Pollard, who will not run, by the way. That car will be out of the race. Steve Prisloff and Lloyd Ruby. Everybody else will move up one. A look at the live view of Indianapolis as we move down to the fifth row of qualifiers. Mel Kenyon, Jim Herdeves, and John Martin. Row six, Wally Dallenbach, Jerry Grant, and Mike Mosley. Row seven is a most interesting row. In row seven, you're going to see come up here in a moment the names of A.J. Foyt, there you have it, Billy Vukovich, and Al Unser, three top racers. Row eight, Roger McCluskey, George Snyder, and Carl Williams. And in row nine, just one qualifier so far, rookie Mike Hiss. So that's the story from Indianapolis. Sam Sessions also got in there this morning. For now, this is Jim McKay speaking also for Jackie Stewart and Chris Economaki, saying so long from Indianapolis.
Every year has been marked by great progress, but none so dramatic as this year. From that first 500-miler in 1911, when the winner averaged just over 70 miles an hour, it was a festival then, an outing. But now it is a deadly serious business. A massive dose of aerodynamics, more horsepower on the ground, more polished driving techniques, growing sums of prize and endorsement money, add it all up, you've got a remarkable community in sports, and the top of the mountain is right here at Indianapolis. The Indianapolis Motor Speedway, home of the Indy 500, the world's richest automobile race. And this is the final day of qualifying. There is still, at this time, one spot on the starting grid in a field of 33 cars available. 32 have qualified. There are at least a half dozen automobiles considered capable of making the field. But time is running out. As they might say in another sport, it is white knuckle time. It is time for that frantic jumping, jumping from your garage to your cockpit. The worry, the fear that you might not make the field or you might not have a chance. Of course, they have been here now for some time. This is the third day of qualifying. They have had their chance, but as usual, it's the gremlins that cause the trouble. Now, the bumping. Wally Dallenbach is the man on the bubble if and when we complete the field of 33. By that I mean Wally Dallenbach is the slowest of the qualifiers. He is not at the bottom of the list by any means. He sits well up in the field. Wally Dallenbach, as a matter of fact, was the 16th qualifier, sitting up on the sixth row. But if the field is filled at 33 and the 34th car goes out and runs faster than Wally Dallenbach's 178.4, then Wally can be bumped out of the field. But he is able to come out and make another run himself and try to regain his position. So Wally Dallenbach will be the man to watch if and when we fill the field of 33 cars. Working with us on ABC's Championship Auto Racing today from Indianapolis, Indiana, world champion racing driver, a man who drove here himself in 1966 and 67, Jackie Stewart. Jackie, I saw you just a couple of days ago, very wet in Monte Carlo. Nice to see you, nice and dry and comfortable. Very warm, as a matter of fact.
There's a big difference, Keith, from Monte Carlo and Indianapolis.
You must be very impressed with what's happened here in the big jump in speed.
I think this year at Indianapolis is perhaps the biggest difference that's ever been in the history of the speedway. I think the car owners, the drivers themselves, and even the old railbirds must be absolutely amazed. I've never seen such a difference, and I myself was very surprised. I think the 195 or even the 196 mile an hour lap that Bobby Unser has made is something almost unbelievable. The speeds at Indianapolis, I can hardly imagine what it feels like to do that sort of thing around this circuit nowadays.
As we move down toward the final hours of qualifying, you've watched it. You're aware of the emotions that are built into automobile racing. It must be getting kind of grim for some of them.
I think right now you're going to see drivers under strain that perhaps they only know once a year, because Indy's the big one. Indy's the one they all come for. They wait the whole year for Indianapolis. And a man like Wally Dollenbach right now is in a situation of really being uptight, because he knows the speed he's done is not really fast enough. There's a whole lot of other runners out there who've got to beat that speed to get in. At this time, the drivers, perhaps the drivers who are not quite so fast and have perhaps not the machinery to do the job properly, are really in a bad position right now.
Chris Economaki, the editor and publisher of National Speed Sport News, down along pit road. Let's see what we can find out from Chris.
Well, Keith, it's a soul-searching time for the crew chiefs down here in pit lane. 178.4 that Wally Dallenbach has to his credit cannot be reached by about 34 of the cars on the grounds. And this is an interesting phenomenon. Of the 81 cars entered, 69 arrived. And of that 69, only 56 passed inspection. But now the mechanics are afraid to send their men out for fear of wasting a qualifying attempt and then not having enough room or time at the end of the line. Dallenbach himself is in a quandary. He has a backup car that has now proven faster than the one he qualified. He is ready to qualify the backup car. He cannot do that, however, until he is bumped. We have just a little bit less than 2 hours of qualifying time remaining, and down here along pit row, for the men who are not in the race, and Wally Dallenbach and his crew, it's Ulcerville.
All right, Chris, thank you very much. At the moment, on the racetrack, there is no qualifying. If and when someone gets to the top of this battle of nerves and takes a car out there, we will. But right now, let's set the grid. Bobby Unser's on the pole, 195.9 miles an hour. In the middle of the front row, Peter Revson, McLaren, 192.8 miles an hour. Outside front row, Mark Donahue, 191.4 miles an hour. Second row, it is Gary Bettenhausen, inside 188 plus. In the middle of the second row, Mario Andretti, former Indy winner, 187.6. Outside the second row, defending national USAC champion Joe Leonard, better than 185 miles an hour. In the third row, it's rookie Sam Posey, better than 184 miles an hour. In the middle, the veteran Johnny Rutherford from Texas, 183-plus miles an hour. Outside third row, Swede Savage, another rookie, 181.7. So those are the gentlemen who sit in the first three rows of the starting grid for the race May 27, which you will see on ABC television, 8:30 to 10:30 Eastern and Pacific time, 7:30 to 9:30 Central time. It will be blacked out in the Indianapolis area. In the fourth row, there's quite a story tied to car number 40, qualified by Art Pollard. Art Pollard is in the hospital with a broken leg. He cannot drive that car. A substitute driver may. That story is yet to come. Steve Kriseloff and Lloyd Ruby make up the rest of the fourth row. In row number five, it is Mel Kenyon, Jim Herdebeest, and John Martin. Jim Herdebeest and Mel Kenyon also above 180 miles an hour. Then we drop down to row six. You find Wally Dollenbach, who is the slowest of the qualifiers so far. Jerry Grant, a remarkable 189-plus, and Mike Mosley, 189-plus. Jerry Grant had only a day and a half in that car. He came in, took a few laps around, went out, and socked it to him at 189-plus. In row number seven, and a very unusual place to find A.J. Foyt and Al Unser, but there they are, flanking young Billy Vukovich, Jr. Row number eight, Roger McCluskey, George Snyder, Carl Williams. We move on down through the ninth row and get into some of the action for today, where Dick Simon, Sam Sessions, and rookie Mike Hiss make up row nine. And the qualifiers today include Gordon Johncock, the veteran, the X indicating today's qualifiers, Denny Zimmerman out just a little while ago, John Mailer, Lee Koosman, and Jimmy Carruthers. So we have only 32 qualified at this time. One spot is still open, and then we'll find out when the bumping might begin. Peter Revson, in practice. Out in practice, has rolled off into the infield. They're taking a look at him. The yellow is out here at the Indy Motor Speedway. And the action has stopped for just the time being. And we're sitting here waiting to see who breaks first in the battle of nerves. And we'll continue with ABC's Championship Auto Racing in just a moment. Peter Revson, who sits in the middle of the front row at better than 192 miles an hour out for practice. He is being towed back, his sleek McLaren heading for the pits. We do not know what caused him to stop, but I think it is worth noting, Jackie, that an immense amount of scrap iron has already been spread around the landscape here.
I think this year, Keith, probably in the history of Indy, we've never seen such terrible mechanical disorders happening to engines. I think the Offenhauser engine has been screwed up with its turbocharger going so hard that it's been bursting engines right, left, and center. Somewhere in the region of 82 engines this year have actually blown. If all of those engines were actually to be destroyed, and of course at this moment that isn't the case, but if it were, there would be $2 million worth of equipment destroyed just in the month of May here at Indy. The reliability in the race is going to be of absolute importance. So perhaps some of the fast runners in the race are going to have to go a little bit slower to save the engines. Because at this moment, if they keep going the way they are, we'll hardly see a car finishing because of the engine blowouts.
The conversation all along, all through the history of motor racing, has had to do with reliability. The reliability factor is what really can ultimately, I guess, win the race for you. Today we saw some fellows go out and qualify, a fellow like Gordon Johncock, who may not be the fastest man around, but at the same time, Gordon may be running at what we would call racing speed. And Gordon Johncock going out today in his qualifying run here turned a very creditable performance. Johncock getting into the field at 188.5 miles an hour. That's quick.
But to do that, Keith, he's already blown 8 engines. Now, this is the sort of thing that's plagued Johncock for the entire week of qualifying here and, of course, the month of May. McLarens have been having a certain amount of trouble with engines, as has every other team. So Johncock's in the race now, and quite frankly, I think he's just a happy man to be in the field.
Is it realistic to consider 188 miles an hour anything near racing?
Oh, yes. I think this is going to be around the racing speed. I don't think the 195 or 96, in fact, is going to be the speed. This is Gordon Johncock doing his qualifying laps here at Indianapolis this morning. These were very consistent laps. He went consistently the whole way, and there he takes the checkered flag. Now, Gordon Johncock's an old hand at the game, and I think in this particular case, he wasn't going out for a really fast speed. He was going out for a good, safe one.
And he did the job at 188.5 miles an hour. Lee Koontzman, a rookie, got into the field, as you see. Jimmy Carruthers, another rookie, into the field, just a fraction faster than Wally Dallenbach. John Mailer, also into the field at better than 179. And there is Denny Zimmerman at better than 180 miles an hour. Those were the qualifiers today. Peter Revson sat on the pole a year ago at now what has to be considered a rather meager accomplishment, 178.696. I was here last year. You were here last year. We all watched him run. A lot of us shook our heads and said, my goodness, that's incredible. But then we turn around and we see what Bobby Unser has done at 195 miles an hour. The factors, I suppose, that have led to this remarkable jump are many.
Yes, I think there are many. I think the main ones, however, are tires, aerodynamics, and, of course, the enormous increase of power. They're closing on 1,000 brake horsepower, I understand, when they've got them really popped up to go. But I think more than anything else, tire developments had a lot to do with it. But aerodynamics are the most obvious. In 1971, you can see by this graphic here that we've got a rear aerofoil, or a rear wing, let's call it, 28 inches from ground level. And the front of the car, the nose isn't too far out in front of the front wheel. Now, this has been changed because we're looking for clean air all the time. And in 1972, we've got a longer front nose and a much higher rear wing. We've got 32 inches above ground level, which means that cleaner air is going to pass over the cockpit, over the driver, the engine cowling, and get to the rear wing itself. The front end also is going to be pressing down on the road much more, therefore giving a great deal more adhesion. Now there we can see the difference between the 2 years, and we can see that air is definitely going to reach the rear aerofoil of the 1972 car in a much cleaner way, and therefore give more downforce, more adhesion, which is going to take more horsepower to drive it along. It's also going to give a lot more bite to the tires. So therefore, there's been a combination of a lot of things, but aerodynamics, I think, have played a bigger and better part. Now, when we see the tires, we can see that they've also had to be altered a great deal. The tire on the right-hand side, in fact, came from the rear end of a 1919 race car that averaged some 88 miles an hour around the speedway. There's not much grip to the road. There's not much area of tire on the road. So, therefore, they were sliding around. The second tire we see here is a 1968 tire, but it did still average 187 miles an hour. It's narrower, it has a tread pattern there, it's got a grip, and of course it was a very successful tire in these days. The next tire we see, of course, is much wider still, and you can see the difference here in the width. And there we've got around 180 miles an hour average on this tire. But here you see the tread, the pattern itself, the little tread patterns on the tire. But the next tire to it is the 72 tire that's doing more than 190. It's completely bald. No tread on it, nothing at all. Only little holes in it to measure the depth of the rubber itself. But this rubber today is adhering to the road in a much better way. Scientists have allowed this to happen. They've married the texture of the tarmac, of the road surface, to the very special ingredients today, the synthetics and the rubber that the tire manufacturers have provided. Now, drafting's included in this great improvement, because when a car gets into the draft or the slipstream of another car, it gets sucked along. It means that the car in front doesn't have any effect really in itself, but does affect a great deal the car behind. It breaks the wind for the car behind, so therefore the car behind can be sucked along and then can slingshot past that other car with a great advantage of speed, because it doesn't have any air pushing against the car. It's got a free run. Now, this is a great art in motor racing today, and when you go into a corner, this really shows up, sometimes derogatorily, because this year in Indianapolis, with the very high speeds, the car, with its aerodynamics, has got to be very careful that it doesn't lose all the wind when it gets into a cornering situation. Now, here we see two cars slipstreaming each other, and you'll notice that the rear car is lower on the road than the front car, because he's got to try and get some fresh air down onto his aerofoils, or he's going to lose all the air. But when he gets onto the straightaway, he tucks right in behind the car in front. He slingshots past it, comes out, gets himself into the best position on the road to take the next turn, and therefore goes into the corner. The car behind him leaves himself a little bit of space so that he can get some air. But from 200 meters back, he can usually make it.
All right, Jackie, there are other factors that this new burst of high speed have brought into force. We'll talk more about them in just a moment as you watch live from Indianapolis.
Terre Haute businessman Tony Hullman earned the salute of racing fans throughout the world as he purchased the Indianapolis Motor Speedway from Eddie Rickenbacker and brought it back to life after the war. The first post-war 500 was in 1946. The cars were pre-war, the drivers were pre-war, and the tires were pre-war. Benson Ford was there with the Lincoln Pace car. No one knew whether the cars would go the distance. It was a great day. The turns at this point had been covered by asphalt, but the straightaway was still the original paving blocks laid in 1911.
Well, let's see. Foyt was out on the practice. Any number of people were out on the practice. We'll have to wait until we can determine the number. A.J. Foyt is in the pits. It is not A.J. Foyt. It is not Foyt. So we'll have to wait until we can determine just who it is.
Here we see the factor of Indianapolis really working at its best. Very quickly, are the firefighters there, the ambulance people will be getting there, there's already medical people there. I think the speed of the emergency equipment in Indianapolis, Keith, is absolutely extraordinary. Very, very good indeed.
We're told that it's car 33. So that'll be Jim McElreath. We'll double-check it and make sure, but it's certainly a bad piece of luck at this time, at this point in time.
The driver did get out the car okay, so I think we can assume that he's all right, so I don't think anyone need worry about Jim McElreath in this situation. If it is him, in fact, it's going to be a big blow for him, because he's been in the race for many years, Keith. He's been a very successful driver at Indianapolis and, in fact, in other races as well. The car doesn't seem too badly damaged because they're still able to roll it away, so he's obviously spun out and got onto the banking in some way, And I think, in fact, you can see Jim McElroy's still there. He's just picking his helmet out his car. In fact, he's climbing back into it to be towed back to the pits.
One of the things that I wonder about, and I know it comes to play in a lot of competitive events in sports competition, but at this point, from here on, is where you start to build your confidence. And to have something like this happen to you, it can certainly be a damaging thing, would seem to me.
This late in the day, certainly for qualifying, it must be very damaging. I think the team that are trying to get Jim McElroy in the race, in fact, are the same team that's got Wally Dolan back sitting in the bubble right now almost. So I think it's for the team, for the mechanics, as well as the driver himself, it's a big bust in the confidence game. But a man of McElroy's experience could probably overcome this better than some of the younger drivers.
Probably very true. Jimmy, of course, having won the first California 500, he's been here many, many times. So let's hope that he's able to bring it back and still get his shot at qualifying, because qualifying is going to end at 6 p.m. Indianapolis time tonight. We'll continue with ABC's Championship Auto Racing in just a moment.
Well, Jim McElroy's not in the mood to talk right now, but the look at his car here, the number 73, doesn't look too bad. But keep in mind now that only a few moments remain between now and the official gun ending qualifications, and it could mean 1972 500 without a Jim McElroy.
And that would be an unusual thing. It would be a rare thing for a Jim McElroy not to be in it. But there are the young lions who are beginning to scratch their way into the starting lineup. And as time begins to expire, 6 o'clock is the deadline, Indianapolis time. Then there will be no more time for qualifying. Then they will have to sit, those who have not been able to make the field. It is conceivable only, however, that we would have 32 starters. There is plenty of time left to fill the field. There is beginning to get growing doubt along pit road as to whether or not there can be too much bumping. We were interrupted in our story of the late history of the Indianapolis 500 by the moment that happened to Jim McElroy. But back in 1909, a group of businessmen decided to have themselves a festival here. They put together a balloon race, and assorted other entertainment devices were brought in, and they had a good time. Then they decided they should have some car racing, so they added that. And in 1911, they decided to have a 500-mile automobile race, and they had one. It wasn't terribly successful from point of view in time, but then it was most successful, and from that has come what we have today, the Indy 500. So again, let's join Chris Economaki for a reflection on the post-war years of the Indy 500.
Terre Haute businessman Tony Hallman earned the salute of racing fans throughout the world as he purchased the Indianapolis Motor Speedway from Eddie Rickenbacker and brought it back to life after the war. The first post-war 500 was in 1946. The cars were pre-war, the drivers were pre-war, and the tires were pre-war. Benson Ford was there with the Lincoln Pace car. No one knew whether the cars would go the distance. It was a great day. The turns at this point had been covered by asphalt, but the straightaway was still the original paving blocks laid in 1911. The first victor in 1946, George Robeson. It was a dramatic race. There were crashes. Parts were failing on the old cars. There just were no spares following World War II. Robeson's engine is six-cylinder, the first six to win since Ray Haroon did it back in 1911. And then Moy Rose came back in the beautiful streamlined, but by today's standards, gigantic Blue Crown Special. It was an easy win for the veteran Indiana man. Hallman then started to improve the speedway, replacing grandstands. Duke Nalen, a front-row starter, had an axle break and crashed the wall, and yet climbed out of this flaming inferno relatively uninjured. Bill Holland finally won. He was Moy Rose's teammate, had said the year before he'd been cheated. National champion Johnny Parsons won in 1950, the first of the younger set of midget graduates to do so. In 1953, the story was heat, intense heat. Carl Scarborough, who you saw get out of the car a moment ago, died of heat prostration. Winner Billy Bukovich was one of only a few men to go the distance without relief. It was a tremendously exhausting race. Vukovic came back to win again in 54, to be the second of back-to-back winners at Indianapolis. But defending his title in 1955, he was involved in a tremendous accident on the backstretch. His car went off the track, tumbled end over end, and it cost the Californian his life.
They laid the engine down in a roadster for Jimmy Bryan to win in 1958, and Roger Ward scored his first victory in 1959. In a leader car roadster, development was thought to be at the ultimate here. Then Jack Brabham appeared at the Speedway with a rear engine car. He didn't know it, but he was starting a new trend. The former world champion placed in the top 10 with an underpowered car in a race that saw a wild accident on the main stretch. The car skidded and spun. Others dodged to the left and to the right. There were T-bone crashes, and then Jack Turner came upon the scene in the back, got sideways, hit the wall, and tumbled over and over. He walked away from this crash uninjured, as did all the other drivers. A.J. Foyt came back to win at a record speed, and then a youngster from California, Rufus Parnell Jones, arrived on the track in 1963. He was the first man to cover what is now an all-asphalt track at better than 150 miles an hour. J.C. Agajanian, who had a winner in 52, was hoping for great things in 63. The press in Indianapolis doesn't wait very long to show their headline. But the winner that year was Roger Ward. He is now an all-pro at the Speedway. A regular victory lane hand. Then Dan Gurney brought the Lotus rear engine car to Indianapolis, having a little bit of trouble here, but it was the beginning of still another trend. V8 engines in rear engine cars. Jack Turner had trouble qualifying what is now an old roadster on the track. He walked away from this accident and the sport of automobile racing as well, calling it quits after two straight flips. Eddie Sachs the next year tried to climb the wall in his car. This is now 1963, and Parnelli Jones dives down underneath and uses the grass to carry on to victory. The checkered flag goes over the only bricks on the circuit now, a 36-inch wide panel across the start-finish line, the rest of the speedway entirely covered by asphalt. Jim Clark zoomed from pole position to lead this race in 1965 in a British-made Ford-engined Lotus. Then, early in the going, a spin took place as Dave McDonald hit the inside wall. His car exploded. Eddie Sachs T-boned it head-on. The resultant holocaust cost both McDonald and Sachs their lives. But there was a plus to it, for it was at this point in time that fire suits were made mandatory, cars were made more safe, fuel cells were ordered mandatory on all cars, and a great emphasis on safety prevailed. Racing continued at Indianapolis, the Memorial Day Classic now being the major sporting event in the world from an attendance standpoint. In 1965, Jimmy Clark, a world champion road racer, added the Indianapolis 500 to his laurel. In 1966, a first lap crash almost at the starting line involved 13 cars as wheels flew off all over. Surprisingly enough, not a soul was injured in this spectacular accident. Graham Hill of Britain was the surprise winner in 1966 after Jackie Stewart's car failed, and then came the 67 500.
White flag for A.J. Foyt. He had two laps to go before, but now all he has to do is negotiate each of these four turns one more time, and it's all over. A.J. Foyt will win his third Indianapolis 500, a great comeback after last year's disappointing season for him.
Well, he drove a great race. He just stayed in there all day long. And there's an accident in the front straightaway.
Two, three, four cars. Where's Foyt? I don't know whether he can get through or not.
Behind the wall. Bouncing back across the straightaway.
Foyt's only got a couple hundred yards to go, but where is he? There he is. He's coming through. A.J. Foyt will win the Indianapolis 500.
That exciting finish described by Jim McKay, Roger Ward, and myself was set up when Parnelli Jones' turbine gave out only a few laps from the end. And a turbine car was to figure prominently in the 1968 race as well. Joe Leonard, who set a qualifying record, won the pole position, led most of the way until suddenly, a few laps from the end, his car would go no further. He pulled it to the side of the track and wondered why. And it's Bobby Unser, veteran from Albuquerque, who tried for so long to score the Indianapolis 500, suddenly found himself leading with just a few laps to go. He roared down the main straightaway and took the checkered flag of victory. The 1969 500 produced perhaps one of the most popular triumphs the Speedway has ever seen. In Europe, they called it Italianapolis. And it also provided one of the most celebrated kisses in sports history as Andy Granatelli kisses his winning Goomba. 1970, it was Allen's for Bobby's young brother, coming home a winner over Mark Donahue and Dan Gurney in a Johnny Lightning special, and he became known as Johnny Lightning. In 71, Team McLaren sent some new and exciting cars to the Speedway, but it was again Allen's, the dominant factor, wearing number one on his car, significant of national champion, beating Peter Revson, A.J. Foyt, and Billy Vukovich. And so the defending champion, Allen's, looks at the 1972 field from 21st starting position.
All right, Chris, thank you very much. We're live from Indianapolis, Indiana. The track has been reopened for practice, and we'll have more right after this.
Andy, the poll says there's one position left open for the 1972 Indy 500, but your number 40 is a doubtful starter. Will there be two positions open, or will you be able to get that car fixed in time to race?
Chris, we fully expect to have the car ready in time to race. As a matter of fact, we scratched our third entry this morning, car number 20, in order to be sure that we would have the entire crew working on car 40 around the clock, since we received just earlier this morning the tub, or the monocoque, was necessary from England to put the car together. So we believe we'll have the car ready in time.
Andy, that's only part of your problem, because your driver, Art Pollard, is in the hospital with a broken leg, and this means you must assign another driver to the car. Can you tell us who that will be?
Well, I won't know for until after 6 o'clock tonight, when we have a choice of whatever drivers are left, because then I'll have the only car with an unnamed driver.
What do you think the handicap this driver will be under with practice having been over with before the 500?
Not really any at all, because I believe our Lola car will handle perfectly, and that the driver will be able to drive competitive speeds.
Andy Granatelli, the man that always has confidence in his machinery. Thank you, Andy. Good luck to you. Back to you, Keith.
Thank you, gentlemen. Jerry Carl of Manchester, Pennsylvania, 31-year-old rookie, has been cleared for a qualification run. If he is successful, he will be the 33rd driver and car to make the starting grid. And assuming, as Andy Granatelli said right there, when the practice closes tonight at 6, he will then select from among those who have not made the field a driver for his car number 40. Now, in case you wonder about what happens to 40, it doesn't stay where it is at all. The car will then be moved back to the back of the field. Everybody will move up one, and 40 will go into the final position with the substitute driver. So, Jackie, the end of a very hot, muggy day here in Indianapolis, and everybody, I suppose, waiting until the final moments so they can get as much cool air as possible.
This is important here at Indianapolis for a whole lot of reasons, Keith. It's important for temperature because engines work better in a cool temperature than in a warm one. It also depends a lot on the wind. Now, for instance, today the wind doesn't seem to be as strong as it was yesterday, so it is conceivable that quite a few people will take advantage of this. But, of course, the last moments of Indianapolis qualifying, I think, perhaps put more strain on any of the drivers than almost the start of the event itself, because these people have been working their year, their mechanics, their car owners, their sponsors, and everyone else are only trying to get in the field. Because once they're in the field, there's a lot of drivers much better in the race than they are in qualifying itself. There's a good many race drivers, in fact, who are much better racers than anything else, because when you get into traffic, it takes a different type of man with a different head and a different technique to get through traffic than it does just to do a four-lap special.
We're still waiting for Jerry Carl from Manchester, Pennsylvania, to come onto the racetrack. He's now winding it up. He's 31, as we said. He won 3 sprint races in his initial competition, started driving actually in 1960 in midgets, and he has worked his way up into the sprint car circuit. So he is going to be looking for the outside position on row 11. Lee Koosman and Jimmy Carruthers, a couple of other rookies, are already sitting in that final row. So car number 58, driven by Jerry Carl, is headed out onto the racetrack. He'll warm it and then try to let it go. So while we're waiting for Jerry Carl's run, let me tell you that you're watching ABC's Championship Auto Racing Series, and we will continue live from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in just a moment.
I think he had a million-dollar personality, and that's why he was so well-liked. And besides the fact that he was a good race driver, and I just...
Tony Bettenhausen, a farmer near Tinley Park, Illinois, a two-time national champion, 21 USAC victories. He died in a practice crash, 1961, here, while testing a car for his friend, Paul Russo. He ran at Indy 14 times. He never won one.
Not a day that goes by when I don't think about him.
That the moment that took the life of Tony Bettenhausen. Billy Vilkovich Jr. was slower to come to grips with racing than was Gary Bettenhausen. Though he was aware of it, the bug didn't bite him, really, until his late teens.
Oh, no, I never got involved or even interested in racing until I was about 16, 17 years old. I was about 10 or 11 when my father was killed, and for all, 5 or 6 years there, I just didn't care about racing. I never did, even when he was racing, not that much. I was conscious of the fact that he raced, naturally, but I didn't really care that much about racing until I was about 16, 17 years old.
Billy's motivation is most direct.
I want to make a lot of money.
The memory of his father etched deeper today than ever before.
Not when you're running at speed, but I've warmed up before. You know, you drive by that spot every time you go by, and I've thought about it. I'm sure Gary Bettenhausen, his father was killed here just on the opposite side of the racetrack. I'm sure he's thought about the same thing. You can't help it. You know, you look at the spot. I've even been playing golf on the outside of the racetrack, and the golf course runs right behind the spot where you got upside down there. You look over there, and you get thinking. I think he's the best. Here, you just look at the record, and as far as I was concerned, he could have won this race 4 years in a row. He was the closest to win it 3 times in a row, and in the year he was killed, he'd have won the race.
Bill Vukovich Sr. drove in 5 Indy 500 races. 1952, he almost won it. He did win it in 53-54. 1955, he died in a multiple car crash while he led the race. As that boy stood at the funeral services for his father, few realized that in time he would follow his father. Time changes all things. We come back live as Cale Yarborough in car number 21 is on the racetrack. And Jackie Stewart, Cale Yarborough is a man that has occupied racetracks with you, and he's awfully close to the wall as I see you win.
Yeah, he was very high in the groove that time, Keith, very high indeed. In fact, he's almost out of it again. He's playing the course very high indeed. I don't know what time he's doing at the moment, but I think he's going to try very hard to get into this field.
178.17. 178.17 is the figure that we have Cale Yarborough on the board with, and that will put him in position number 33. Let's see. I'm waiting for the flag. Does he have the flag? I don't think. There's the white flag. One lap to go. So if he can hold on here, 178.1. We'll certainly put him in the field because the 33rd position is open. But it makes him most vulnerable.
Very close to the edge. He's obviously going to take it as a qualifying time, Keith, but I think he's very vulnerable for being in a position of being later this afternoon beaten. It's very close. I think that Cale knows the problem. Obviously, his crew know the problem. They're allowing him to take the flag, and he's on his last lap now. So here he comes up. He's getting into it. He's coming off, I think, the fourth corner now. He's coming on to the main straightaway. He's coming in, and he came in at 178.3 on the last one. He's going to take the checkered flag now. And he waved him off. He didn't take it. He waved him off. The crew waved him off because he was just too close to the line.
And I would think that Wally Dahlenbach was probably his biggest fan on that run, because if he had stayed out there and taken the flag, he would have been the slowest qualifier, and it would have given Wally Dahlenbach just a mild respite anyhow, with just a little more than an hour to go. You're watching ABC's Championship Auto Racing. We're coming to you from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in Indiana. We will continue in just a moment.